Great. As people keep coming in, I'll go ahead and jump in. Thank you all for coming. I'm Rachel Zegsworth, VP of Marketing at Lerner Publishing Group, and very excited to have you join us today to talk about LGBTQ history in children's literature. Our webinar is being recorded today, and we will send out the link to the recording along with the book list in the follow-up email. So we're going to be compiling the book list. Don't worry about taking notes for all of the hopefully great books that will be dropped into the chat as we're talking. We do have auto-generated closed captioning enabled. If you would prefer not to see the closed captioning, you can click the button called Live Transcript at the bottom of your screen to turn that off. If you have any questions for our panelists, please use the Q&A button below. We have a staff member keeping an eye on that, and we'll try to get to questions at the end of the presentation. If we don't get to your particular question, we'll try to answer it by email afterwards. You can also use the chat feature for questions or just general thoughts, as well as those book recommendations. But we'll start by looking in the Q&A box when it's time for our Q&A session. Please note that abuse of any kind will not be tolerated, and anyone violating this policy will be summarily banned from the webinar, but I'm sure we won't have to worry about that today. If you are live tweeting along, we'll be using the hashtag queer history is everywhere, so please feel free to join the conversation online. And with that said, we'll jump into our discussion. First, I will introduce our panelists. Melanie Gilman is a cartoonist and colored pencil artist who draws positive queer and trans comics for young readers. They are the creator of the webcomic and graphic novel As the Crow Flies, published in 2017 by Iron Circus Comics, and Stage Dreams, published in 2019 by Graphic Universe, an imprint of Lerner Publishing Group. Stage Dreams was named a Children's Book Committee at Bank Street College Best Children's Book of the Year, a finalist for Excellence in Graphic Literature Awards, a YALSA Great Graphic Novels for Teens, and a Prism Award nominee. In addition to their comics work, they are also an adjunct professor in the Comics MFA program at the California College of the Arts, where they teach classes about making comics and professional practices. Rob Sanders is a teacher who writes and a writer who teaches. He is known for his funny and fierce fiction and nonfiction picture books and is recognized as one of the pioneers in the arena of LGBTQIA+ literary nonfiction picture books. Rob's nonfiction books continue to break new ground, including the first picture books about the Pride Flag, the Stonewall Uprising, a transgender Civil War soldier, a gay presidential candidate, and the first gay marriage in America. His work also continues to introduce readers to heroes of the LGBTQIA+ community, from Harvey Milk to Gilbert Baker, from Cleve Jones to Bayard Rustin, and more. His fiction explores friendship, relationships, standing up for others, and being allies. Blood Brothers, his first middle grade novel, written in powerful raw verse, releases in spring 2022. And Rob pays it forward. He serves as co-regional advisor for SCBWI Florida and is a frequent speaker, teacher, mentor, coach, and critiquer. Lee Wind is the founding blogger and publisher of I'm Here, I'm Queer, What the Hell Do I Read?, an award-winning website about books, culture, and empowerment for lesbian, gay, bi, trans, questioning, and queer youth and their allies. He is the author of the crowd-funded young adult novel Queer is a $5 Bill, celebrated by Publishers Weekly as an indie success story, and the Junior Literary Guild Gold Standard Selection No Way They Were Gay, Hidden Lives and Secret Loves, published earlier this year by Zest Books, an imprint of Lerner Publishing Group. Lee also works for the Independent Book Publishers Association and the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. Now I'm going to hand it off to our panelists to talk a little bit about their work generally, any specific books that they want to highlight, in particular, and then we'll jump into some questions. So first I'll stop sharing my screen so you can see our panelists. All right. So Melanie, I'll toss it over to you first.
All right. Well, hi everyone. So Melanie Gilman here. That was a great introduction that Rachel gave, and that covered most of the bases. But probably the book that we'll end up talking the most about for me today is Stage Dreams here, which is a lesbian Western romance set in 1861 New Mexico, so right at the start of the Civil War, and dives into not just, queer romance and fun Western hijinks, but also the history of women spies in the Civil War, which is a really fascinating topic. So it was a lot of fun getting to marry those two elements of the narrative together and find ways that they could interact in this story.
Thanks. And then Rob, anything you'd like to say about your body of work?
Well, I'll just throw some books up on the screen. So, and as I'm showing them to you, Pride, the Story of Harvey Milk and the Rainbow Flag, my first nonfiction. And that kind of got me started writing nonfiction. I also had a history of already doing some fiction, Peaceful Fights for Equal Rights, Stonewall, A Building, an Uprising, a Revolution, The Fighting Infantryman, which is about Albert D.J. Cashier, Trans Civil War Soldier, Mayor Pete. This year, Two Grooms on a Cake came out, which is the story of the first legal gay marriage in America in 1971 between Michael McConnell and Jack Baker. And today is the book birthday of Stitch by Stitch, Cleve Jones and the AIDS Memorial Quilt, which has garnered two starred reviews, which I'm really proud of, from one from Kirkus, which, like, did God ever think that would happen in my writing career? I don't know. And about my, since we're talking about queer history today, my novel in verse that comes out in the spring is a historical fiction book that explores HIV and AIDS as it was prevalent in kids, especially those with hemophilia in the 80s. So kind of like the Ryan White kind of kids, you know, that some of us remember reading about. So that's a bit about my writing.
Thanks. And then Lee, over to you.
Sure. And Rob, congratulations on the book birthday. That's exciting.
Thanks.
What a nice way to celebrate today. So I'm gay, and I didn't come out until I was in my 20s. And I spent a really long time from age 11 to age 25 actively hiding who I was every day. And then once I came out and got honest with myself and everybody else, I had this moment where I was told that there were these letters that Abraham Lincoln had written to Joshua Fry Speed that convinced the person that was telling me that Abraham was in love with Joshua. And I was like, that can't be true. That just seems crazy. But I went and I got the letters from the library. And when I was reading it, I had this goosebump moment that it was like, oh my gosh. There was one moment when Abraham writes Joshua, they'd lived together for 4 years, and then Joshua moves back to Kentucky and marries this woman named Fanny. And Abraham writes him and says, are you now in feeling as well as judgment, glad that you're married as you are? And back when I dated girls, when I was closeted, that's exactly how I felt. I just kept wondering, would the feeling come? But I judged that it was the right thing to do. It was what everyone told me I was supposed to do. So I just was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. So I started doing all this research, and I became convinced too that Abraham was in love with this other guy. And I decided that that would be a cool book to write about a kid that discovers this real stuff about Abraham Lincoln. So that became Queer as a $5 Bill. But when I was doing it, there was just so much evidence that kept coming up. And I was just like, there was more and more and more. And at one point I just was like, look, I can't shove this all into a novel that's supposed to be a page turner. What if I did a nonfiction book? But I hated nonfiction when I was a kid. I thought history was really boring. I felt really left out of it. So anyway, I decided, what if I did a nonfiction book that was more about like rethinking history altogether and taking, oh, this is my version with all my notes, but like taking the idea of the false facade of history that we're all taught and crashing it down. So with Lincoln and Speed is one chapter, and then there's other chapters about Abraham Lincoln, about Mahatma Gandhi and Eleanor Roosevelt and Wewa, really talking about like men who loved men and women who loved women and people who lived outside gender boundaries in history. And that is what I am obsessed about right now, trying to get the primary source materials directly to kids and sort of bypassing the hundreds of years of historians that have denied it. Super cool.
Thanks to all of you. That is a much more interesting summary of your work than I could have provided. So I'd like to talk about why it is important for you as a creator to share stories of LGBTQ history, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. Why is it important to focus on history as opposed to or in addition to modern day fiction or nonfiction? We'll start with Rob.
Well, I come at my writing from the perspective of a teacher, because I taught in elementary school, public school, for many years, took early retirement last December. But one of the questions I'm asked most frequently by adults is, why do you write such controversial books? My answer is always the same. I don't write controversial books. I write books about history. to me, what would be controversial is to not teach history to kids. So I write books, so my nonfiction books in particular, so kids know the history of the LGBTQ plus community, so they can see themselves and their families represented in books, so they can grow an empathy and understanding of others, and so that if or when the day comes that they might realize they're part of the LGBTQ community, they'll be better prepared to step into who they are. So in other words, it's Rudine Sims Bishop's Mirrors, Windows, and Doors, that I'm hoping that my books will do that by giving kids a historical perspective of the community that I'm a part of.
Thank you. Melanie, you can go next.
So there's lots of reasons for doing queer historical fiction. One of them is because it kind of flies in the face of one of the most popular ways that especially conservative and homophobic people are going to try to dismiss modern day LGBTQ people, which is by saying that this is some like new thing, or it's a fad, or it's, you know, just, you know, these crazy kids who are coming up with some wild stuff here. And diving into queer and trans history is a way to look backwards and say, no, this is a like normal historical part of, you know, human existence for as long back as we have records. It's also a matter of preserving what archives and records we do have, because not enough work is being done, in my opinion at least, in order to preserve a lot of those archives and preserve a lot of those records, which makes that historical research a little bit more difficult to do than if you're researching, you know, your straight and cis historical figures generally. So there's also something to be said for going through the act of doing that research and finding a way to input that research into even a fictional work as a way to help better preserve what records we do have out there and keep them more fresh and more alive in modern day readers' minds. And even with historical fiction too, like one of the things that I found while writing Stage Dreams was that, you know, if I had tried to sit down and write a straightforward nonfiction account of one specific queer or trans person's life in the American West in like the 1800s, it would have been a very difficult task, because it's not that there weren't queer and trans people at the time, it's that their lives were not documented very well. And a lot of those documents that did exist have been lost over time or deliberately destroyed. But one strength of historical fiction is that it allows you to take a number of fractional stories and fractional accounts and find a way to weave them all together into a solid narrative whole, which is imagining what life would have been like in general for someone who would have been alive back then, even if we can't always very easily point to, you know, rich and, you know, very well documented sources about one single individual person's life. So historical fiction is a fun way to take what records we do have and find a way to lend a sense of narrative completeness to them that draws from a number of different sources, while still accounting for the fact that it is difficult oftentimes to do this research. And, you know, there are periods of American history where a lot of records that we wish existed are not there in the way that we wish that they were. But this is something we could hear about more from the folks who are writing more nonfiction in this room too, because definitely the research aspect is gonna be an interesting task whenever you're dealing with queer history in general. And I'd love to hear from other folks about that process for them.
Yeah, I'll just jump in if I can and just say that, you know, Melanie, that it's so true. You know, things do get changed by historians, by family members, by people themselves, in an effort to sort of sanitize their queer lives, and it's usually not to benefit the people who are queer. It's usually to benefit the sort of structures of power that have been set up. Which is why there's this false facade of history in the first place, that we are still teaching kids today, that are still being taught to kids today, the history textbook my kid in 10th grade had could have been my history textbook from 10th grade. Like, it was just the stories of like rich, white, straight, cisgendered, able-bodied white men from Europe that were wealthy. And, you know, I think that when I actually asked the teacher about it, in a way that I was hoping not to be too confrontational, I said, well, what about all the other stories? And they were like, well, we have lots of good supplemental material for that. And I was like, okay. So like eventually we'll have to get to the textbooks too, but yeah, at least there are some other things, and I'm excited that we're crowdsourcing this list. But one thing to keep in mind is that every little story is a crack in that facade. And what I was trying to do, rather than just focus on like a whole book about like Lincoln and Speed, was that if we show lots of cracks in the facade, where there's stories of men who love men and women who loved women and people who lived outside gender boundaries, maybe we can take the whole facade down. And then it's not just our queer stories, but it's the stories of women and people of color and disabled people. It's all these other stories that don't get told from history as well. And I think that that's really exciting, because once you actually recognize that this is this huge like thing that's being pulled on all of us, right? That we're all being denied the real stories from history. And that's really exciting. And if you can get kids to sort of recognize, you know, show them some of the ways that history has been sort of like, you know, sanitized, and let them go back to the primary source materials. I'm obsessed with primary source materials, because I think that like, when we can get them clean, they can hear these voices, they can read the love contract between Mahatma Gandhi and the guy he loved, Hermann Kallenbach. I mean, they wrote a love contract together. Like, it's incredible. And I think it changes how you see history and how you see yourself. And what, going to what Rob said, with, you know, it is the windows and the mirrors and the sliding glass doors. And it is also the knowledge that, like, if someone like me existed in the past, then I think that I have a better right to a place at the table today. And if I think I have a right to a place at the table today, the future that I can imagine is without limits, right? And we want that. Like, I don't have a time machine. I can't go back and give my book to myself. But it's amazing to think that we can pay it forward and we can let kids know this now. And you can help.
That's great. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
No, we lost you again.
Is that working? Ah, very good. All right. So all of my Zoom controls have disappeared again. So we'll see how the rest of this goes. I've got my colleague who may end up feeding questions into the chat if I disappear for some reason. At any rate, we'll jump into our second question. How did you find or develop the specific historical topic that you shared in your book? And then one thing that just jumped out at me as you all three were talking about your books, there is a Civil War theme running through here. Is that a bit of a coincidence, or I'm thinking it may also have something to do with records that are available from the 1800s compared to things that are available, you know, further beyond. Maybe there's nothing there, but I think it's interesting that we've got a little bit of a theme. So Lee, we'll jump back to you. How, and I know for your book in particular, there were a bunch of things that you had additional materials where that didn't end up making it into the book. You know, how did you narrow it down to what you did cover? And then how did you do the research for it?
Oh, it was so hard to narrow it down. In fact, at one point the book had 15 chapters and I was basically given a choice because of the page count, because there's a lot of like endnotes and stuff. The page count was getting bigger and bigger and we needed to like kind of cut. And so I had a choice. I could either cut the chapters more, so there would be less primary source materials that we would be discussing about each person, like the chapter about Shakespeare writing all these love sonnets to another guy. Instead of there being, you know, six examples of the sonnets, we'd have to go down to three. Or I could just take out three of the chapters. And so I chose to take out three of the chapters because I really thought that like there are a lot of overview survey books that are like a little bit here, a little bit there, here's one quote. And that, I didn't want to do that. I really wanted to put the materials in front of young readers and be like, hey, this is how I read it. Hundreds of years of historians disagree with me, but look at it. let's talk about it. I'll tell you the tricky tricks that people use to try to change pronouns and other ways of hiding this, but read it with me. And then you make your own call. Do you think that William Shakespeare was in love with this other guy, mysterious Mr. W.H.? And I love that. And then, you know, it was very important for me to show that, like, I didn't make any of it up. So, like I said, there's a lot of footnotes, but also the team at Lerner were great sports, and they agreed with me that we could put in bold all the primary source materials, because I thought that was really important. Like, when you just glance at the book, which, by the way, is so beautifully designed, it's so easy to see, like, oh, that's a quote, that's a direct quote from a primary source. And I love that, because I think that that's one of the things we want to, you know, encourage kids to have some literacy about how to read and how to absorb information and how to know, is this real or is this not? And then I just went to town on EndNotes and just kind of, like, you know, that was my adventure. It was like reading something in an adult book, this row behind me, that's all of my queer nonfiction, mostly for adults. And I would, you know, find something and I'd be like, okay, what was the source for that? And then I'd go and I'd get that source. And I'd go back and back and back until I could actually, like, find the original source. And it was a bit of an adventure, and I like it because it's, you know, it's an adventure everybody can do.
Great. Rob, over to you. You've highlighted a number of specific incidents or, you know, specific moments in history as part of your books. How do you decide what you want to focus on compared to all of what is out there?
Yeah, I am very much a person that can, if I connect personally with a story, if I get goosebumps or my heart palpitations, that I am interested, I know I'm interested in telling that story. Or if I think it's a story that really, really has universal truth to it that a lot of readers could benefit from, as well as it illuminating some of LGBTQ history, that it makes it a great topic. When I was researching, Pride came about, the first nonfiction book came about, because of one of those emotional moments. It was 2015, the SCOTUS marriage equality decision. And that night, some of us will remember that the White House was illuminated in the colors of the rainbow flag. I never thought that day would happen as a person of my generation, let alone that occurrence that night. And as I looked at the White House, I knew that my students, fourth graders, would have seen a pride flag, but they wouldn't have known who created it, what was the inspiration for it, what's its real meaning and value to the community. And so I set out to write that story. And that night I had written the first draft before the lights were turned off on the White House. But then came what has to come with nonfiction, which is research. Lots and lots of research. And like Lee was saying, many secondary sources are out there, television shows, a movie, a magazine article, that will lead you to primary sources. And so that's always the quest, the ultimate primary resource being if you can ever come into contact with the subject themselves or someone who was at the actual event that you're writing about. That's a great vetting source for all the research that you do as well. Probably, to me, the most difficult part of any of this, though, is finding a way to make a story interesting and engaging to kid readers and to find an entry point to that story. So that's what I spend a lot of time doing in addition to research, is trying to figure out, how do you make a wedding interesting to kids, especially a wedding from 1971? Why would they care? Well, I thought back to my childhood, what did I care about if I went to a wedding, which I seem to have gone to a lot as a kid? The cake. I would care about the cake. So I told parallel stories, how a cake is made and how a relationship is formed. And stitch by stitch, a poem weaves its way through the entire book. So the kids can read that poem offset in different font, kind of like Lee was saying. Or they can read the story, or they can read the two as they weave together. So those entry points are really important to me, so that kids really get into that topic and want to turn the page and want to read the book again and want to share it with another reader that they know.
Great. And Melanie, how did you choose this particular time and place for your story? And then, you know, you mentioned some of the challenges of researching, and I love the combination of multiple individuals' experiences into a greater whole, but how did you do research for it?
So this was, you know, the research process that ended up coming to fruition in Stage Dreams really started several years beforehand. There was a while where I was doing annual historical nonfiction queer history comics for a little independent newspaper in Denver called Westward, where every year I would pick a random like queer or trans historical figure from usually the 1800s in Colorado history, and I would research them and end up drawing a little comic strip about their life and have it in the newspaper. And I ended up doing that enough that I sort of was starting to get a feel for like who are the queer and trans historical figures that we know enough about that I could tell a like little, you know, half page comic strip narrative about them. And a lot of those ended up kind of leading me down the rabbit hole of, you know, primary sources, etc., for historical figures in the American West. And I was really attracted to the idea of doing a historical fiction story set in the American West in the 1800s, partly for genre reasons, because, you know, when you're adding in elements of a Western in there, you're allowed to play around with elements of like, you know, adventure and escapism and romance and like, you know, high drama and espionage and all of these like fun, enjoyable, fictional conceits that you can kind of weave into the narrative. So it ended up just being a very fun sandbox to play in as a storyteller. And for me too, you know, one of the things that I want to provide to readers, because it's a thing that I crave myself when I'm looking for books, is just narratives that are queer and romantic and fun, but also very escapist and adventurous in nature. Like, you know, I'm trying to move more away from narratives that are strictly tragic or going to be about violence and discrimination, and was more interested in telling stories which are just kind of like fun and goofy and adventurous. And because of genre reasons, there was a lot that I could play with in the scope of a Western narrative there. So ended up pulling in a lot of that, dove down the various rabbit holes, researching as far as I could in various historical figures, and then found fun ways to kind of weave everything together. Yes, centering queer joy in a narrative, especially when you're writing for children, I think, where, you know, it's important to give them, you know, not saying that we should never be telling stories about like discrimination or violence or whatnot, but we need to have some balance there too, where we also want to be putting things out into the world which are like joyful and loving and fun at the same time too. So this was a good chance to play around with all that type of stuff in building a narrative here.
And that totally came out. I mean, Stage Dreams takes all of the best of all of the tropes of a Western and puts them in a graphic novel, and just the whole read is super fun. And you know, the storyline is there's romance, there's drama, there's adventure. And there's no, you know, there's discrimination, but it could be for anything. So it's a very humanizing, you know, and fun for any kid. Windows, mirrors, and doors, again. So you all have talked about this a little bit, the importance of primary sources and really getting that through to the reader, not just using it, you know, for your research, but sharing it back to the reader. In both Stage Dreams and Robin, your picture books, this is done through back matter. Lee, your whole book is effectively, you know, that kind of back matter. But what, especially when it comes to fiction, and so, you know, Lee, going to your novel here, what is the role of that kind of research and sharing it? I know, especially in Stage Dreams, Melanie, you include information on trans people in history, but also just other facts about the time and the place. So how did you decide what you wanted to have your back matter highlight? We'll start with Melanie and then go over to Lee.
So knowing that this was going to end up being a book which would be primarily serving younger readers, middle school, high school, et cetera. One thing that I wanted to make sure was that the back matter text was both informative and added nuance, but was also fun too. So it was a combination of, me bringing in historical concepts and ideas that just provide a little bit more scope and nuance to the types of background that's happening in the story itself. I mean, one fun thing about historical fiction in general is that it's sometimes hard to get the characters to explain things to the reader without it sounding very expository and boring. So sometimes the back matter is me being let me walk you through a little bit of what the context is behind this. Why is this character who's riding a stagecoach really disappointed to find a chest full of banknotes rather than gold? Why is that a thing which would be really frustrating in 1861? So things like that. And also finding ways to incorporate some stuff that was just fun little background details. I had a scene that was set in a tailor's shop in the 1860s. So I got to talk a lot about the various tools that would have been used by tailors at the time, which are very different than modern day tools. A little bit about the history of fashion and the way that it moved across the American landscape from east to west and why that was happening. So a combination of fun, silly facts that inform some of the background imagery that's going into the comics, and also areas where I want to provide some additional nuance and additional information, stuff that, you can't really fit into the narrative itself without making the characters do an exposition conversation with each other, but it's still useful for readers to know. So finding a balance between fun and exposition and hopefully aiming towards something which is going to be informative, but also very enjoyable to read too. I don't think that back matter note should ever be a dry read. They should be fun too.
Yes, and
Lee, I agree. I agree completely with that. That was so cool. And it was very cool to learn about the bird that held the fabric. I think about it a lot in terms of layers of text. Remember what Rob was just saying about how he had his poem and he also had the story and they sort of wove together throughout the book. So I think of back matter as sort of it's a layer of text that's at the end of the book, but I think there's also a way that you can think of back matter as just layering text. In my novel, sure, I had, a whole endnote section that chapter by chapter explained, what was real about the bold, what was real about the primary sources, what was real about the evidence that the main character was discovering about Abraham Lincoln being in love with another guy. In No Way They Were Gay, I had a lot of additional layers of text because I had my story that I wanted to tell, here's this person, this is, giving him a little background. And then here's this incredible stuff that you didn't know about the person. And here's some of the primary sources that sort of back that argument up, but let's go into them. And then when I was sharing primary sources, I actually wanted to get into it. I wanted to be okay, well, this is why I interpret this line in this way. So I was I could do footnotes, but then I'm going to have footnotes and endnotes in the same book. Oh my gosh, that sounds horrible. So I thought about, remember VH1 had pop-up video where someone would be singing and then it would be boop, and that little factoid would come up next to them. So that's the idea that we came up with. And so there are all these sort of pop-up notes, here, this is a little description. It's actually a transcript, a quote from a transcript of a video on YouTube talking about the two-spirit identity. And the character says, well, this label has only been used since the 90s. And then I did a little pop-up next to it that said the 1990s, because kids aren't necessarily going to know that. And so that enabled me to do another layer of text. Sidebars are another layer of text, right? There are all these additional fun things that you can get across. Photos are another visual layer of text, right? Like, I mean, I know it sounds weird to call them text, but they are. They're another way, you know, this is the mask of Kolomana, which in Zuni culture sort of was this spiritual figure that literally the hairstyle was, you know, half in the female style and half in the male style. So like getting to show kids that kind of stuff just enriches the entire experience, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. Like, and in fact, I had photos in the back of the fiction book as well. So I think that for me, that's the most fun way of thinking about it, is that like, how do you give them like their own adventure in discovering the book? Because like Melanie's book, you could just read it straight through and not even straight through, sorry. You could read it directly through and not even, you know, look at the back matter. If you chose to, that's one way of reading it. But then you could read the back matter and then go back and read the story again and see it in a whole new way, because it does make more, things make more sense. So I love the idea of it being layers of text.
That's a great way to think about it. Rob, how about with your picture books, you know, getting primary sources in or back matter or layers of text?
Well, and Lee, what you're describing, teachers and librarians would call text features. And it's a whole nother level of learning to read as a reader, that you have to not just read the text, you have to read all these other things to get the full meaning of what you're reading. And so it's a whole thing in elementary school that we learn to read text features. I suppose you do in middle school and high school too. Probably back matter serves all the purposes that Melanie and Leah said in picture books, but may serve another purpose as well, because the picture book audience is a younger audience, often, let's say maybe 6 to 10, maybe younger, maybe older. We know that middle school and high school teachers use picture books a lot in instruction as well, but that's the primary focus. So you can't put all the details in the story. A, it'd be overwhelming. B, it won't be a very engaging story. So back matter often serves the purpose of telling the rest of the details, telling the rest of the story. And it also serves a purpose of telling why I wrote that story. That author's note is really important to give a human connection, because that helps readers to know, oh, well, that's a reason I might read that story too. So all the wonderful things that are possibilities in back matter, you know, from timelines to mini bios to glossaries and all those things, just add a wealth. And I think that there are readers, I know there are readers, teachers, librarians, and students who read back matter first because they're that kind of reader. They're interested in that kind of thing. Just as I was as a kid, I was the kid who read encyclopedias. We had encyclopedias at our house. I know that's online now. People don't even look at those like we did, but they were books. And Collier's Encyclopedia put out a yearbook every year. And so I would read about everything that had happened in the world that year, you know, just article after article, and you could flip wherever you wanted and read whatever you want. That's what back matter addicts are like too. They like those facts and then they'll read the story, you know? So it serves a lot of purposes and allows us to do a lot of creative things as well as the writer.
That leads me really nicely into the next question, you know, having the author's note as a, making the connection of the book to your personal approach to it. So I'd like to ask each of you, what do you hope that readers will take away from your work? And I'm using an expansive definition of readers here, because in many cases, the decider for the purchase of these books may not be the end user, you know, the child who's reading it. So I would encourage you to think both about the child who may be reading or having the book read to them, as well as the teacher or librarian or parent who is maybe the gatekeeper to getting there. So Rob, we'll start with you. What do you hope readers take away from your work?
Well, and do you know that many of my books are bought for adults? They're gifted to adults. Two Grooms and a Cake's given to lots of people on their wedding days now, you know, and other books when someone comes out, or my gay son is graduating from college and I want to give him a book, and they'll choose a picture book. And it's just very interesting. And often history is as new to people in the community, adults in the community, as it is to children. We didn't grow up, I didn't hear Walter Cronkite talking about the Stonewall Uprising. You know, I had to learn, I learned about that as an adult. It happened when I was 10 years old. So our books serve those purposes too, helping adults. But I start everything from the kid perspective. I've already said that. And I know that kid readers, I know that kids in general are incensed by injustice. You can't be on the playground with kids without hearing somebody say 100 times, that's not fair. Or if you're in a classroom, if you do anything that at all is not equal among your students, another student will point that out to you. And this sense of fairness means that when kid readers are confronted with what seems unfair, if it's discrimination or lack of understanding or unfair laws, they get riled up and they begin to root for the underdog, the oppressed, the underrepresented. And they begin to appreciate when fairness and justice are finally realized in that story. So I want my books to rile kids up. I want them to see that injustice and realize that wasn't fair, and be able to recognize how injustice was corrected or corrected to some point, so that they, when they see injustice, will know that they can do something about it too. But I guess I write books so kids will get riled up mostly.
That's great. That's wonderful. Melanie, what do you hope readers will take away from your work?
So one of the things that ended up being really interesting for me when I was doing the research for Stage Dreams and diving into, you know, whatever historical documentation I could come up with for queer and trans folks who were living in this particular area in this particular time in American history, is that I found more accounts than I would have thought coming into this, where you had queer and trans people who lived lives that, while not being completely free of, like, you know, discrimination, violence, etc., were much like happier and more loving than I would have expected for the 1800s. These are people who had jobs, who had husbands and wives, who had families, who had supportive communities surrounding them. And that was something that I really wanted to honor in this book, because it feels like a counterpoint to what we would normally, I think, intuitively expect about the lives of historical queer and trans people in, you know, hundreds of years ago, where, not saying their lives were perfect and not saying that there was not discrimination and strife and struggle, but these are people who had loving and supportive communities around them very often, and who were living authentic and loving and rich lives in many cases. So that's kind of the thing that I hope that readers take away from this: the ability to imagine a past for our own queer and trans ancestors, even within our own country, even in periods of time where discrimination would have been a major factor, where you could not live out life in the same way that you could today, but still finding ways to imagine the lives of our ancestors in ways which had like richness and nuance and loving and community to them, in ways that I think, you know, a lot of mainstream depictions of historical figures who are queer and trans oftentimes kind of fail to grapple with. So I hope that's the thing that people take away, that, you know, the history of our ancestors is a little bit more complicated than a lot of mainstream media representations are doing justice to. And, you know, there are a lot of stories, even in the far distant past, of people with communities, with families, with loving and rich lives and relationships surrounding them. And that is a thing that should be a comfort to us, and should be a thing that we honor when we're talking about our own queer history.
That is great. Lee, what do you hope readers will take away from your work?
Oh my gosh, I love both of those answers so much. So I think that to begin with, I want to say, like, I hope that readers, whatever their age, understand that history doesn't have to be like medicine. that it can be like chocolate, that it can be fascinating, and it can also, that it can include them, that they can belong. And, you know, whether it's the queer kid that is reading it and sees a reflection of themselves, whether it's another kid that isn't queer but recognizes that there were queer people in the past, and that, wow, if they can maybe be a little more kind and be an ally to the queer kids in the class with them. And I think, like Rob said, there's queer adults that it's okay to nurture your inner teen that didn't get it, your inner kid that didn't get it, and let that be a healing for you. And then for other adults, to let them know that they really need to stand up and be allies for the queer kids too. So I think all those corridors, I think, is really important. And again, like this idea that, you know, the past, knowing that you have a place in the past, empowers you today, and that is fuel for your future. I think that's what I keep in mind a lot.
Yes, that seeing yourself in the past gives you can see yourself in the present and future. I love that. I'm going to do a quick call for anyone who is watching. If you have books that you think this group should know about, either the panelists or the other folks who are attending, please add your booklet recommendations into the chat box. We'll be compiling all of those along with all the books published by all of our panelists and a bunch of other recommendations that have come in. We'll be sharing that book list along with the recording. We'll send that message out, you know, tomorrow or by the end of the week, certainly. Once we do all the research on the books and make sure that we've got the correct links for them. But please do drop your book recommendations into the chat, because the next question I have is to our panelists: how do you encourage teachers, librarians, parents, or, you know, for the older middle school and high school readers to find more books like yours? Lee, we'll start with you.
Okay. The ALA Rainbow List. This is really, really helpful because they've all been vetted by these librarians at the ALA, and it is great for a librarian to be able to point to and say, well, it's on the ALA list, that's why it's in the collection. The Stonewall Book Awards. These are also really, really great books, and also look at the nomination list, not just the ones that get the award. My blog, sorry, not shameless plug, but I have been blogging about LGBTQ kid literature for 14 years. So you can sign up there's a weekly newsletter with new books every week. The crowdsource list we're building today. And then I think that this is really important. It's really important to drive interest, right? Like, we want to, again, back to that idea that, like, it's fun, it's chocolate, it's not medicine. So one of the things I did that is fun that I'll toss in the chat too is that I created a BuzzFeed kind of quiz. You know, those BuzzFeed quizzes, like, which Disney princess castle would you live in? And then you take a bunch of, like, quick questions to answer. So I did one about queer history. That's really fun. And it's just like these, some amazing moments. I mean, the book is called No Way They Were Gay, because I had all these moments researching. I was like, no way. So that's a really fun thing that you can do too, to drive interest. And then you have the books and you have interest and you're changing the world one reader at a time.
Thank you. And Rob, what are your recommendations to help folks find books like yours?
Everything Lee said, because that's exactly what I had on my list. And then I would, what Lee was alluding to there at the end, when you find those books, make other people aware of those books. Kid readers, other influencers, teachers, librarians, parents, and become that kind of resource for other people. I think the most important, for some reason in my mind, I think we have a lot of teachers and librarians maybe tuning in. And I think the ABCs of being an advocate is A, to be an advocate or an ally for kids and other adults with whom you work. B, to be knowledgeable about books, because books are a source of inspiration and sanity for many who are trying to figure out who they are. And C is for conversation, to start conversations with others so that you become the safe, welcoming person that people know is knowledgeable and wants to be a source of help.
And Melanie, what are your secret sources for finding great books?
So absolutely all the things that have been mentioned before. Certainly one, probably one of the easiest things to do is to look up awards and keep an eye on who, you know, what books are being both nominated and winning. In addition to the ALA Awards, the Stonewall Awards, et cetera, things that I would also recommend would be things like the Lambda Literary Awards, which is another LGBTQ specific list of, you know, awards for queer and trans books that comes out every year. Also in comics, we have something called the Prism Awards, which is a comics and graphic novel specific awards for queer and trans literature. Those are always great every year. I also think there's a lot to be said for using social media where, you know, if you find a book that you really loved by, you know, by a queer or trans author, maybe follow them on Twitter for a few months or so and see like whose books are they promoting? Who are they talking about? What are they reading? You know, kind of crowdsourcing your own recommendation from the authors whose books you already know and love can be a really great way to do this. And one other resource that I will shout out, which is comic specific, is the Queer Comics Database or Queer Cartoonist Database. I forget which one it is. It's run by Mari Naomi. And this is a free online database of LGBTQ cartoonists who are working today. And that is something which is very easy to look through online, and that is going to give you a very rich resource when you're looking for queer and trans graphic novels that are going to be a good fit for your classroom or your library.
That is a fantastic list of resources. I just, I'm chatting with my colleagues saying, wow, they're just writing our follow-up email for us. So we will include links to all of these resources in the follow-up email in case you've been frantically scribbling stuff down. We'll be sure to include all of that. Once again, for folks who are watching, please do drop your book recommendations into the chat. And then we're going to do a quick lightning round here with our panelists. What are your favorite books on LGBTQ history for young readers? It can be yours or they can be anybody else's. Anything we haven't mentioned yet here today. Melanie, we'll start with you.
One very, very well-known one in the comics industry that you should absolutely like 100% read if you haven't gotten the chance to yet is called The Prince and the Dressmaker. It's by Jen Wang. It's this beautiful, like middle grade two YA graphic novel, kind of a like fairy tale Cinderella narrative with a trans romance right at the heart of it. And it's just, it's beautifully drawn. It's just like an absolute pleasure to read. And I want to say there was some news that came out several years ago, and I can't remember what's happened with this, about some sort of like movie musical adaptation that's in the works for this. So it's gonna be a big thing in probably another year or two. And it's already a big thing in comics. And if you haven't read it yet, like really do treat yourself to this book, The Prince and the Dressmaker by Jen Wang. It is a wonderful, lovely book.
Thank you. I saw that one come in. Someone had suggested it in our forum where we're collecting these recommendations. And when I was, you know, cleaning up the spreadsheet, I ordered it from the library because it looks absolutely beautiful. I had not heard of it before. Lee, over to you. Favorite LGBTQ history books? I know one of yours already.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was going to, I was here with props. I have Melanie's books. I have Rob's books. So I think I wanted to just add Melinda Lowe's Last Night at the Telegraph Club was beautiful historical fiction for older teens with an incredible back matter about like San Francisco lesbian lives. It just, oh my gosh, it was so great. Sarah Praker, I mentioned the sort of survey books. Sarah has one called Queer There and Everywhere, which is for young readers, which is like 6-page chapters about different people. And there are some cool people that I learned about. But really, I'm obsessed with primary source material. So you get to see my rainbow bookcase, and we get to go there because I think that you can share the sonnet, Shakespeare's sonnets with kids from something maybe a little less intimidating than the Riverside Shakespeare. But like, how cool would it be for kids to get to hear Shakespeare say, "Two loves I have of comfort and despair, which like two spirits do suggest me still. The better angel is a man right fair, the worser spirit a woman colored ill," right? Shakespeare's talking about the two, like he loved a man and he loved a woman. And how amazing would it be for them to read Eleanor Roosevelt's letters to Lorena Hickok, and they can actually hear, and I'm just reading it from my book because it's easier, where Eleanor writes, "Lorena, your ring is a great comfort. I look at it and think, she does love me, or I wouldn't be wearing it." Like, how incredible is that? And then they can read from the autobiography that Christine Jorgensen wrote, Christine's line, where she writes in a letter in 1950, "I think we, the doctors and I, are fighting this the right way, make the body fit the soul rather than vice versa." And then they can, you know, understand the context of like why Christine became world famous for having gender affirming surgery. Like, it's so exciting. And I don't think that we have to think, I don't think that we need to save the primary sources for when you're an adult. I think kids can handle it. They can handle complexity. They can handle layers of text, and they can handle the truth about history, which is that there are queer people in history.
That's wonderful. I love the show and tell. Rob, what are your favorite books on LGBTQ history for young readers?
I would encourage everyone to look for the books of Gail Pittman, who is arguably the pioneer of nonfiction picture book, LGBTQ topic sorts of things. And I would recommend this book, Gay and Lesbian History for Kids, The Century-Long Struggle for LGBT Rights by Jerome Polin, which is written for kids, has activities embedded in it. And it's just a great overview of history that could spark interest and could lead kids to do additional research on topics they're interested in.
That's great. I know that one came in several times in our recommendations. So lots of votes for that. We've got a question from an attendee. Why isn't there more, especially more nonfiction books or just more books generally with elder LGBTQIA plus representation? Anyone want to take that one?
Well, there are a lot more than there used to be. And when, just think about Pride Flag and or Rainbow Flag books. When my Pride book came out in 2018, followed 2 months later by one by Gail Pittman, those were the first two nonfiction about Pride Flag. There's probably 10 or 12 books now from board books on. So it's a growing genre. I think publishers are very open. That's been my experience. I probably have published books with 5 or 6 major imprints. And some not so major. But I think that they are interested in getting well-written books into the hands of readers. And I would say, why don't you help us write those? Because what we need are more own voice authors writing their story and our collective stories.
Yes, that is critical, the own voices part especially. It looks like we've got about 2 minutes. I have one last question for everyone, which is, what are you working on next? I know some of your upcoming projects. Rob's we've talked about a little bit, but I want to give you a chance to talk about it again. Lee, we'll start with you.
Sure. So I'm actually working on the sequel to No Way They Were Gay, which is called Gender Bender. And it's all about how the gender binary is really a social construct, and that gender in itself is a social construct. And it starts out by this great quote by Alok Ved Menon that says, "There are as many genders as there are people in the world." So I'm really excited about that.
Great. And Rob, over to you.
Blood Brothers comes out in the spring. That's my novel in verse. Next year, sometime, the dates are still kind of iffy. There'll be a biography about Jean Manford, co-founder of PFLAG, and another co-authored with Carol Boston Weatherford about Bayard Rustin, the man behind the march on Washington, who was gay and African-American. And we're bringing our two voices together to tell that story. And I've recently sold a collection of poems that are nonfiction poetry collection about a lot of our political pioneers in the LGBTQ arena here in the States.
Wonderful. And Melanie, what are you working on?
So I'm working on a ton of stuff that has not been announced yet. So I have to be a little cagey about how I describe these. One of them is going to be a collection of original queer fairy tales, which I believe should be coming out in fall of 2022. Looking forward to that one. Also working on a children's horror graphic novel with a non-binary protagonist, and I'm so excited for that one, and I wish I could tell you more, but watch the sky. Eyes, I guess.
Perfect. I'll also throw out a pitch, and we'll include this in the follow-up email. You can follow all of our great panelists on Twitter, where I'm sure when they are able, they'll be talking about all of their projects. We are right at 1 o'clock Central Time, so we'll wrap it up. I just want to say a special thank you to all of our panelists. This was such a great discussion. I'm really looking forward to seeing this book list that we put together, and we are at Lerner, we're committed to telling both modern and historical LGBTQIA+ voices, and really want to help people find the books that are out there and then publish more of them. So thank you all for attending. Thank you to our panelists for joining. And like I said, we'll send up that follow-up email in the next couple of days with this book list, and then we'll just go out and celebrate these books and get them in the hands of kids everywhere. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Lerner Podcast. Tune in again next time for more author interviews and the stories behind the books.